Hello, is anybody there? Judy.
Brandela.
Yep, I got on a while ago, but it hung at me up. I don't know why. I was the first one on there for a long time, then all of a sudden just went off. So I had to turn around and call back.
Well, I don't know. I had gotten another call and I put him on hold. And then I'm just coming back on. I had to hang up and I'm just coming back on. So I don't know. I don't know whether he stopped. Is this an all-night study?
I don't know. I know he said he had to take a break. So
Oh.
he had to take my break. Did you catch the spelling of that Joseph Hasidic? I got the Hasidic, but how do you spell Joseph? Did you get the spelling on that?
No, I imagine it's Joseph, Josephph, huh?
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. I caught some of it.
The only thing is to listen to it tomorrow. Maybe he'll
Yeah.
say it again. Man, I got to get
Yeah,
up early in the morning.
oh, you do.
Yeah, I got, they're going to finish, the city's going to come Wednesday and
Oh.
finish doing what they're going to do with
Oh, I
that
see.
place. So
Yeah.
tomorrow's my last day to get all to finish all that stuff.
Good evening. How's Samaya?
Good evening.
Talk to Maya.
What's the matter?
So I will be continuing not quite where I left off because I don't remember the words. We'll start with
Okay.
Elisha and Shem Yehud. Lashem Yehud Kud Shabri Hu Ishkin. Where I left off, generally speaking, I was attempting to describe the idea of the within Yesod, the 10 different sefirot within it that are composed of five chasadim and five givurot. They have the same names, they're just presented to you in two columns rather than three. And the idea is that the two columns come together in unity to form the central column. This is a very deep concept that takes a lot of time to understand. Rabbi Ashlag has 16 chapters in his 10 luminous emanations describing this process of how the infinite light diminishes itself to become capable of not destroying the physical world and yet be in the physical world. Trust that eventually you will understand what I've been saying. Or trust that I don't know what I'm talking about and you don't have to worry about it. The real discussion tonight is about Joseph HaTzadik. And the first thing we need to do is light a candle. And there's no special prayer to say, it's just the consciousness of connecting to Joseph this evening. While he is in his body, in his grave. So I have lit the candle, and now we can go on into our study. As I said, there is nothing special other than the consciousness. And that's the desire to connect to the righteous Joseph HaTzadik. The question is, why is Joseph called righteous? And it comes from the story of Potiphar's wife, who desired Joseph because of his beauty, but more importantly, because of his energy. As an energy-sensitive woman, she wanted to be with him intimately so that she could siphon off that life force that she sensed was in him, that he was capable of sharing. So the other question that I started to talk about is, what does it mean to be a chariot of one of the Sephirot? We know that Abraham is a chariot for Chesed, and Isaac for Givurah, and Jacob for Tiferet, Moses for Netzach, Aaron for Hod, Joseph for Yesod, and King David for Malchut. But what does it mean to be a chariot? A chariot is a wagon for war, a wagon designed to be an efficient war tool. Where is the war? What is the war about? It's the war between Hashem, who has lowered himself to be equal to the negative system. So the positive system and the negative system, and everybody knows and thinks that there is a conflict between good and evil. But at some point you start to realize there is no conflict between good and evil. Because everything that we perceive as evil, ultimately, it's for our benefit and comes to the good side. That takes a very deep evaluation of your own life, an honest evaluation of your own life, your own mistakes, your own benefits, your own positivity. And then you will realize that all of the negativity, all the mistakes you've made, all that chaos that you feel is really a benefit. Whether it's cleansing, whether it's growing, it's a part of a system that will bring you to complete your tikkun. But a chariot is part of that war. That's why it's called the chariot. That's why we use the chariot. The sages could have just as well said it's the wagon driver. Of course, it's not as nice sounding as chariot, but it's just as valid. Joseph is a chariot for Yesod, which means that on the physical world level, his consciousness is connecting to Yesod constantly. Or should I say his unconsciousness? One of the ways metaphorically to understand tikkun is to perceive the split in our minds between conscious and unconscious, that the tikkun is expanding the conscious mind to include the unconscious mind. To do that expansion step by step, ultimately everything that is now unconscious will be available and made conscious. That is the completion of the tikkun. That is one metaphorical way of understanding it. Joseph, on an unconscious level, and if he had completed his tikkun, which more than likely he did, he would be on the fully conscious level, would include all of his unconscious motivations. He would know himself intimately. What motivated him to do X action? But on the physical level, he still had an unconscious mind. And he did not know what his motivations were. There are midrashim about how at the moment that Potiphar's wife had disrobed and he was fully erect and he was had what's referred to in modern day pre-cum, so that he was dripping sperm, supposedly 10 drops of sperm that represented the 10 martyrs, that represented the 10 brothers that sold him into slavery. Joseph, at that moment, did not see the woman, did not see the beauty of the woman. He saw his father's face. And with that image, he was able to control his desire for the woman, which he had the desire for the woman. He had the lust for this woman, but he was able to control it. And that is why he is called righteous, because the core definition of righteous is to control your emotional desires. Rabbi Berg would constantly want to connect to Joseph, not to the Sefirot of Yesod, but to Joseph, by utilizing the channel of a tzaddik to connect to the Sefirah. Remember, what is a Sefirah? It's a level of consciousness representing lack. It's not fulfilled. But when a person becomes a chariot for that Sefirah, their action of restraint, their action of binding by striking, draws the light that fulfills that particular Sefirah. With that in mind, we are ready to start reading from these three handouts. Not sure we'll get to all three of them tonight. We'll see. I mentioned earlier where you can find them by doing a Google search under the name Joseph HaSadiq. And there are only two links that show up. And I'm reading from the first one that comes from the JTS website. And as I said, JTS is the school that puts out rabbis and cantors associated with the conservative movement. I'm starting to read. I should ask, are there any questions before I begin? I have always been deeply curious as to why, of all the characters in the Torah, the rabbis attributed to Joseph the appellation HaSadiq. the righteous. In actuality, the Torah does that. But for most people, Joseph is called HaSadiq because they're studying the Talmud or they're studying the Zohar, which I don't think this author did. And the Zohar and the Talmud both call Joseph HaSadiq, the righteous. No other character in all of the Tanakh is given this attribute by the rabbis. That's not quite true, because Benjamin, his brother, is called HaSadiq as well. And yet, what was so righteous or compelling about this hero who takes the center stage for these last four parashiyot of the book of Genesis? These four are Vayeshev, Miketz, I forget the name of the third one, and the fourth one is Chaye. It's the last one where Jacob blesses all 12 tribes and adopts the two children of Joseph. I have never found him such a sympathetic character. But clearly the rabbis must have seen something in his person or his development that warranted remembering him as the righteous, HaSadiq. The fact that Joseph refused the sexual advances of his boss's wife seems to be a very low bar for righteousness. There must be something more substantial. We are introduced to Joseph as a boy of 17 who brings bad reports of his brothers' behavior to his father, slighting them in order to win the love of his father. And then, of course, there are his dreams. To say that Joseph was a deeply self-involved young man is only the beginning of the story. Joseph also almost makes Narcissus look like a sensitive soul. One might have thought that being sold into slavery by his brothers would have forced Joseph to reevaluate his preoccupation with self-love and his ability to be sensitive to others. And yet, this experience seems to have changed Joseph very little at first. Rashi, echoing the Midrash from Bereshit Rabbah, explains why. In the middle of the narrative about Joseph's experience in Egypt, the text comments, "Now Joseph was well built and handsome." Rashi's comments, "As soon as he saw himself a ruler in Potiphar's house, he began to pamper himself with food and drink and curl his hair. Said Hashem, 'Your father sits in mourning, and you preoccupy yourself with curling your hair? I will send the bear, that is, now I will send Potiphar's wife after you.'" Rashi's words not only explain how the moral challenge of Potiphar's wife's seduction came about, but I believe they also respond to some emotional dissonance felt by the reader of our story. Jacob is in such pain that he refused to be comforted, saying he will go to his death mourning for his son. And in the meantime, Joseph is living the high life. In Rashi's comment, the reader hears his or her own voice asking, "Joseph, what are you doing? Are you tragically still that narcissistic young man?" The author's questions have great value. They're not quite accurate in their portrayal. And in that sense, they're good for us to learn how exaggeration creates untruth. Because Joseph was not living the high life. According to other Midrashim, he was in jail. Not in jail yet, but he was in jail to the Potiphar, this advisor to Pharaoh. But he was required not to make his own actions, his own decisions, but because of his life force, energy, because of who he was, he was drawing energy that Potiphar sensed, needed, and demanded of him. But he was his slave. Joseph had no choice but to provide that. There are archaeological finds that indicate that in Egypt, it was not hard labor that the general slaves went through, but that they were utilized as middle management. They were utilized to draw the energy that they could then utilize to move the stones that built the pyramids, to carve the smooth edges that made them work. There is archaeological evidence to that, even though that's not the accepted Western world view. So the question is, was Joseph this narcissistic man? Or was, by being put in control of another human being, Potiphar, was he forced to confront why he was there? Why did this happen to him? How had he abused his brothers so that they would do these actions with regards to him? Was he doing his self-evaluation of his midot, of his character traits? Or was he just skipping around, attracting women, being put in charge of Potiphar's house and grounds and wealth because he had access to the Yesod energy, even if it wasn't matured? He was drawing that energy and it was noticed, and so he was put in charge of the props. He was put in charge of whatever business interests Potiphar had. He was in charge. He ordered everything, and Potiphar was the one who was lazing around. And of course, he came in contact with Potiphar's wife. And we know the Midrash story is all about how the matrons that were visiting her, upon seeing him and recognizing that energy that I've referred to, we're constantly saying, how can you not force him to be with you? He's a slave. I'll continue to read now. Joseph has power and has gained a measure of success in Egypt. Why doesn't Joseph send a message to his father? Surely he knows how much pain his absence has caused Jacob. On one level, we understand, as Joseph will remind us at the end of the story, that Joseph's experiences in Egypt were all part of a divine plan. Now do not be distressed or reproach yourselves because you sold me hither. It was to save life that God sent me ahead of you. there's a midrash that says if Joseph, before he came into the world, had not agreed to be sold into slavery into Egypt, then Jacob would have had to go down to Egypt in chains. What is that story all about? The plan of creation says that a nation must be created. A nation is a group of souls of 600,000 males and females. Anything less is not a nation. So, Joseph is saying to his brothers, don't be worried about it. It was part of God's plan. I agreed to, before I came into my mother's womb, I agreed to go through this process. Now it's over. We are growing into a nation. Stay with God and follow the plan of creation. Now, are these my words? Are these intellectually correct? That's up to you to decide. But Joseph comes down to Egypt, and he becomes the king of Potiphar's property, of Potiphar's castles, palaces. Potiphar, as an advisor to Pharaoh, had a significant amount of the country's wealth. Potiphar gives him control of this wealth. Does it make sense? Of course not. Is it true? Of course it is. How do I reconcile that? For me, it's simple. There are energy-sensitive people in the world who can meet someone, sense the power of that kind of energy, of their ability to connect to the Sephiroth directly to become a chariot. And if they can manipulate those individuals, they will do so. Continuing to read. Yet on another plane, this is a story about a son and brothers and a father. How could Joseph allow his father to suffer? Moreover, if everything was God's plan and there was no room for individual moral fortitude or emotional sensitivity, then why did Joseph earn the title the righteous? Where is the personal growth and transformation that the reader is hoping for? I wouldn't put it that way. The reader is expecting that emotional growth and transformation because that's what we are taught is the goal of tikkun. So we would expect to find it in the Torah. And this author is saying, I don't see it. And I will remind you the answer to that, to the question, why doesn't he see it? Because you see what you expect to see. Continuing to read. We have to wait until the end of our story. We are told at the beginning of chapter 48 that Joseph was informed of his father's illness. It is at this moment in the narrative that the rabbis locate Joseph's emotional transformation and self-growth. The Midrash in the collection known as the Pesikta Rabbatai asked, why did Joseph need to be told that his father was ill? Surely if he visited him frequently, he would have known. The Midrash uses this, perhaps a forced and manner for a moment to identify Joseph's greatness. The purpose of this is, however, to make known to you his righteousness. The Hebrew word is tzedekah, that he did not want to be alone with his father, so that he should not say to him, "What did your brothers do to you?" And Jacob would be prompted to curse them. Now that's a reasonable possibility. Joseph didn't want to tell his father, because if he told his father would ask, "What happened?" And Joseph wouldn't have had to curse his brothers, but he would have had to explain that his brothers sold him into slavery. Could he have said, "I got lost on the way to my brothers, and I was captured by the caravan, and they took me down to Egypt"? But then the question becomes, how did the coat get bloodstained? I'm continuing. As the Ramban will suggest, based on this midrash, when the rabbis read this story, they concluded that Jacob was never told of the deeds of his brothers. Perhaps he knew, but Joseph, the once tattletelling son, never related the brothers' deeds to their father. Had Jacob known about the sins of the brothers, the rabbis imagine the brothers would have begged Jacob for his forgiveness before he died. This is the moment the rabbis were waiting for. Joseph is able to transcend his narcissistic self. Joseph imagines the pain that it would cause his father to learn what his sons had done to Joseph, and how they were willing to cause Joseph and Jacob such pain. Sure, by telling his father, he would have his revenge, but at such a cost. Joseph is able to put aside his pain and desire for revenge, and he forgives his brothers. He has muted his own desire for revenge because he knows the pain it will cause his father. Still, at that moment, when Joseph reveals himself to his brothers, and he sends his brothers back to talk to their father and to bring Benjamin back into Egypt, do you think that they talked to Jacob and said, "Dad, we're really sorry? We put you through this pain and we didn't realize how strong your pain would be"? You see how the Midrashim fall apart. They're real. They're possibilities. But there needs to be a further, deeper analysis. A psychological analysis, and then even at a higher level, a spiritual analysis, for us to understand why Joseph didn't inform Jacob, why his brothers didn't inform Jacob once they knew that he was alive. Continuing to read. The rabbis use this moment in the story to redeem Joseph. They adopt him as the paradigm of a man who is able to transcend the self-involvement and extreme insensitivity for others and transform himself into a man who subsumes some of his feelings for the benefit and the feelings of others. Joseph is no longer the hair-curling young narcissistic adolescent. He has emerged into a model of a human being who can grow and transcend an earlier iteration of his self. It is in this way that Joseph offers us a path to true righteousness. That is the end of this essay. Does anyone have any questions or comments or thoughts? I'm now going to read another essay titled Joseph, Tzaddik or Tattletale. And this is from an organization called the My Jewish Learning. The complex character of Joseph raises questions about what it means to be righteous. And this is by Rabbi Sharon Nars. The made for stage story of Joseph begins with this week's Torah, Vayeshev, and will continue for the next 4 weeks until the end of the book of Genesis. From the outset of the portion, it is clear that Jacob favors Joseph among his 10 sons, giving him the infamous Ketonet Pasim, the coat of many colors, which is a corrupted translation, or ornamental tunic, along the same lines. This preferential treatment, as well as Joseph's penchant for sharing egocentric dreams, angers his brothers. The brothers react harshly, selling poor Joseph into Egyptian slavery. In Egypt, Joseph demonstrates surprisingly strong character by resisting the lurid designs of his boss's wife. At 17 years of age, Joseph tended the flocks with his brothers as a helper to the sons of his father's wives, Bilhah and Zilpah. And Joseph brought bad reports of them to their father. Now, Israel loved Joseph best of all his sons, for he was the child of his old age, and he had made him an ornamental tunic. And when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of his brothers, they hated him, so that they could not speak a friendly word to him. Once Joseph had a dream which he told to his brothers, and they hated him even more. He said to them, "Hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were binding sheaves in the field, when suddenly my sheaf stood up and remained upright, and your sheaves gathered around and bowed low to my sheaf." His brothers answered, "Do you mean to reign over us? Do you mean to rule over us?" And they hated him even more for his talk about his dreams. He dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers, saying, "Look, I have had another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me." And when he told it to his father and brothers, his father berated him. "What," he said to him, "is this dream that you have dreamed? Are we to come, I and your mother and your brothers, and bow low to you to the ground?" So his brothers were wrought up at him, and his father kept the matter in mind. Now, just for an aside, every dream has some aspect of a lie. A dream is 1/60th of prophecy, but there is an aspect of the lie of a sheker in every dream. And the rabbis use this dream of his father and his brothers bowing down to him, his brother, father and mother and 11 others bowing down to him. Because there is a lie in that description. Where is the lie? Rachel dies in childbirth. Rachel is Joseph's mother. So it can't be that his mother bows down to him. It is true that his 11 brothers bowed down to him. It's true that his father bowed down to him, but his mother did not. Continuing to read, your Torah Navigator. Do you believe that Joseph understood that the two causes of enmity against him, namely his tendency to tattle on his brothers and receiving Jacob's favoritism, might lead to jealousy and disdain on the part of his brothers? If so, what do you think motivated him to still reveal his dreams to his brothers? And the second question, based on these opening lines describing young Joseph, do you feel that his tribe should later merit the title Hasadik, or righteous? The questions are good questions. How would you answer them? My answer is that we are utilizing normal human behavior to evaluate a chariot. And chariots don't act with normal human behavior. Joseph does not have within him the character trait of jealousy. And therefore, he cannot see jealousy in his brothers. I've explained that a number of times, that you can only see what you expect to see, and you can only see what is your mirror to show you yourself. Joseph has no jealousy, and therefore, he can't conceive that his brothers would dream that he would think of him in a jealous way. So he keeps telling the story, the different dreams, because he's telling the truth about what he is forecasting as the future of the 12 tribes. This is the nature of the chariot. This is the nature of the chariot for Yesod, which has all 10 from the other Sephirot. Parshanut commentaries. Jewish tradition has much to say about the causes of enmity against Joseph. even traditional rabbinic commentators, are troubled by the young man's behavior. Some authorities claim that the act of dreaming the dreams itself was reprehensible, as it exhibited visions of grandeur that Joseph obviously nursed during wakeful moments. The commentators understand the brothers' hatred of Joseph and express shock that he would reveal not just one, but two dreams. Why then does Jewish tradition refer to Joseph as HaSadiq? Some commentators ask. Such overweening pride and self-importance seems remote, indeed, from the conception of righteousness implicit in the title, writes contemporary scholar Nathama Leibowitz. Elie Wiesel does battle with this notion as well, asserting that Joseph was the singular ancestor called righteous in a line of great patriarchs. Countless traditional commentators offer that Joseph's greatest act as Sadiq came in resisting the temptation of Potiphar's wife. He was also said to be consistently God-fearing in a secular world and humble in a position of power. But Wiesel is not satisfied. The Nobel laureate knows from later Torah portions that even while Joseph was praising God's divine wisdom, he was endlessly scheming his own next move. While he embraced his Abrahamic origins, he kept one foot firmly planted in the secular Egyptian culture that rewarded him. A word. The Joseph saga raises the question of how contemporary Jews choose their biblical role models. What can we learn from these eminent characters with all their internal flaws? Their morally imperfect behavior, their all too human shortcomings. There is a fine line between being righteous and being self-righteous. In Hebrew, the distinction is between being a tzaddik, righteous, and being tzaddik be'enav, righteous in one's own eyes. He struggled with his own divinely ordained charm, which was both the source of his brother's enmity and his effectiveness as a member of Pharaoh's court. Wiesel only accepts Joseph as HaSadiq because it is a righteous person who resists 10 temptations in human relationships. Joseph is crowned Sadiq because he ultimately forgave his brothers for selling him into slavery and compassionately helps his family move to Egypt during a time of famine in Canaan. Joseph succeeds in vanquishing his bitterness and turns it into love. What does all this mean? Wiesel asks. That one is not born a tzaddik, one must strive to become one. And having become a tzaddik, one must strive to remain one. Does anyone have any questions? Hopefully there are people listening.
I'm listening.
Thank you, Brandy.
I'm listening too.
Thank you all. Anybody have any questions? Remember, without a question, there's no vessel to reveal the answer. Our next section is also a Google search for the word Yesod, Y-E-S-O-D. And the first link that came up on my search was from inner.org, which is he is a Kabbalist, Rabbi his name isn't immediately available to me. It'll come eventually. Rabbi Ginsberg. He's very much a mathematician and a gematria person connecting to some tremendous insights through gematria. But he is describing the Sephirah of Yesod in this essay. And if we understand Joseph, we should be able to understand Yesod. So let's see if we do. Yesod is the ninth of the 10 Sephirot, and the sixth of the emotive attributes within creation. Is there a relationship between the number 9 and the number 6? That's a question I am asking. You'll notice that the letter 6, when turned upside down, is the letter 9. Yesod appears in the configuration of the Sephirot along the middle axis, directly beneath Tiferet, and corresponds in the Tselem Elohim to the procreative organ in the male, and in the female to the womb. Yesod is associated in the soul with the power to contact, connect, and communicate with outer reality, represented by the Sephirah of Malchut. The foundation Yesod of a building is its grounding, its union with the earth, Malchut. Corresponding to the creative organ of man, Yesod is the foundation of generations to come. The power to procreate is the manifestation of infinity within the finite context of the created human being. Each individual man is a small relative to all the generations to come from him. The Yesod is referred to as the small limb of man, the small that holds the large, the infinite. The Yesod is the small and narrow bridge between the infinite potential of procreation that flows into it and its actual manifestation in the progeny of man. For this reason, the Sephirah of Yesod is identified in the Torah with the Tzaddik, the righteous one, as is said, and the Tzaddik in the foundation of the world. And the Tzaddik is the foundation of the world. In particular, this refers to the one perfect Tzaddik of the generation. In the very body of the Tzaddik, finite and limited in time and space, God's infinite light and creative life force becomes manifest. The Tzaddik procreates on the spiritual plane as well as on the physical plane. He experiences procreation in the inner eye of his consciousness, in the continual flow of new insights and true innovations in Torah. He procreates by arousing the souls of his generation to return to God and the Torah. And so did Rabbi Schnauer Zalman of Liadi say with regard to the first mitzvah of the Torah, be fruitful and multiply, the foundation of the Torah. A Jew must make another Jew. The Yesod is also referred to as the Brit, the holy sign of the covenant that God made with Abraham, the first Jew. In particular, the Yesod is the covenant between the two divine attributes of truth and peace. As the prophet says, "And truth and peace shall love." The origin of love is represented by the soul of Abraham, of whom is said, "Abraham, my lover." All of his loving kindness, his chesed, flows down as water to become concentrated in Yesod. There it creates the covenant between the absolute truth of Torah and the peace of mitzvot, good deeds performed with love for Israel. Just as foundation implies beginning, so is Yesod called the conclusion of the body, where the body, Tiferet, extends until the procreative organ, Yesod, as is said, body and brit are considered one. The property of peace, shalom, inherent in Yesod, means as well the power to bring an act to its conclusion, as our sages teach us. One who begins a mitzvah is told finish. Thus, the full sense and power of the Sefirah of Yesod is its ability to manifest the union between beginning and end. As is said in the Sefer Yetzirah, the end is enwedged in the beginning, and the beginning in the end. Yesod, which is equal to 80, which equals 8, the Chet, times 10, the Yud, 5. The Tzaddik is called Chai. 80, Klal, the general or entire body of the Jewish people. The Klal, the Tzibur, the entire community, never dies. The Tzaddik, the Yesod Olam, is the general soul, the Neshama Klalit of the generation. The six Sefirot from Chesed to Yesod join and develop to form the Partsuf of Zeranpin. Zeranpin receives its head or brain power. The three higher Sefirot of Chachma, Bina, and Daat, or Keter, Chachma, and Bina, from the higher Partsufim of Abba and Ima. The spiritual state identified in Chassidut as corresponding to the Sefirah of Yesod is that of Emet, truth, in the sense of the power to verify one's convictions and emotions in action and to achieve true self-fulfillment in life. I did not make many comments on this essay. It's not that the essay itself is really clear as it's written, but it does take contemplation, and I did not want to direct your contemplation. But once you have determined for yourself and contemplated Yesod, feel free to comment to me or to question, send me questions that you find appropriate. So finally, does anybody have any questions? I'm ready to call it the evening complete at this moment. There are a lot of unanswered questions about Joseph, among which is, why did he choose to leave this world on this 27th day of Tammuz, 10 days after the 17th of Tammuz. Remember, in his generation, he did not have the golden calf. So he thought that the 17th day of the month of Tammuz was a powerful day. He thought it was a day, based on his prophecy, he thought it was the day that the nation would be formed and the tablets would have been presented to the nation. What would have happened 10 days later? That he chose to leave this day. Perhaps he was able to see the golden calf, and he knew that we would need this help of his in the 3-week period. Or perhaps it wasn't part of his tikkun and Hashem would not have shown it to him. Then what was the 10 days? It was a manifestation of the tablets that were given on the 17th day. Shalom Gadol to all, unless someone has a question or a comment. Thank you for joining us.
Shalom. Thank you.
Shalom, brother. Thank you.
Thank you. Shalom.
Shalom. Thank you for your teaching.
Thank you all.
Shalom. Thank you.